This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I'm going to start with a brief poem from Mary Oliver, I believe. It's called What I Have Learned So Far. And she, like me, is an octogenarian, so she's had a long time to work on this. A very highly regarded poet. She starts the poem, and it's a little bit long, that it's talking about why she doesn't spend her days sitting in meditation on the hillside within the wonder and awe of this. And I want to add as preface, I personally disavow storytelling. I think words lie, so I don't like to talk. So in the context of that, her poem ends with a stanza, "All summations have a beginning. All effect has a story. All kindness begins with a sown seed. Thought buds toward radiance. The gospel of light is the crossroads of indolence or action. Be ignited or begone." So in that context, I'm well ignited and burning a little bit. There's five fears that we talk about in Buddhism: loss of life, loss of livelihood, loss of mentality, loss of one other, and then the final one is public speaking. And I'm particularly sensitive, but burning. And I want to say a few words about our orientation, aspiration, inspiration. In Western culture, this started with the Greeks, and of course, like all cultures, they had their gods, but they also had something called ideals, and among them were truth, goodness, beauty, love, compassion, like that. And many cultures, subcultures within the Greeks, actually found these to have a reality that was beyond human, beyond nature. One example was in mathematics. The Pythagoreans found mathematics, and particularly truth, to be kind of a provable thing, but completely outside of nature. So these ideals, this idea of truth and equality and justice and compassion and love, actually are our common human direction, but in some sense they transcend humanity, so they're up in the realm of the gods, pretty much. And relative to that, Christianity came along, but it's a little bit different. Has two aspects. One is the monastic practices, very similar to Zen, and the other is the church and authority practices. We have basically the teachings of the Buddha carried down through 2,500 years. They're a little bit monastic and a little bit rule-bound in orientation in their practices, but they also have the parish aspect. And that's how this particular temple, retreat center, came about. Because Koban, the founder of this temple, came from such a temple in Japan that had a community-oriented practice. It's basically led by people who are graduates of monastic practice and many other things, and then becomes part of the community life. Many other influences. I also want to read a poem that to me has some relevance on what this is and how it functions. And it's actually paraphrased from a very famous poem by two other ancient teachers, Hanji from the 11th century or 12th century, I believe, and Dogen from the beginning of the 13th century. Hanji's poem begins with, "The hub of the Buddha's activity," well, it's actually called the acupuncture needle of Zazen. So that's the very... He says, "The hub of the Buddha's activity, the turning of the ancestors' hub, is known free of forms, illuminated beyond conditions." And that goes on. Dogen, after Hanji, changed that slightly to, "The hub of the Buddha's activity, the turning of the ancestors' hub, moves along with your non-thinking and is completed in the realm of non-merging." So those to me are wonderful and inspiring, and I'll be happy to read the rest of them if anyone is interested. The point of Zazen, the point of sitting still, is a question, what it does and what it, how it affects itself in both the monastic and in the parish, the retreat center, why we're doing it, how it works. So I paraphrase them shamelessly, and I call it the heart of Zazen. "In the heart of the ancient practice, to free and awaken all beings, compassion grows through upright non-thinking. Love blossoms through upright non-hindering. As your compassion grows through upright non-thinking, your mind flirts with immediacy. As your love flowers through upright non-hindering, your mind's dualities and your fixations on self fade. As mind approaches immediacy, defilements and hindrances drop away. In upright non-thinking and non-hindering, your experience is neither general nor particular. If your true or original nature resumes itself, your immediacy evolves with no obstacles. If your intimate experience is neither general nor particular, your upright effort is without desire. Clear water all the way to the bottom, a fish swims like a fish. Vast sky transparent throughout. A bird flies like a bird." I'll try.
After the hail stops.
A few comments on the poem. In Zazen, key words are non-thinking and non-hindering. And the hindrances are, of course, just the five hindrances of Buddhism, which are things like greed, anger, slothfulness, worry, and distraction. Those are the things that hinder us in sitting, and they take the effect usually of thoughts, recurring thoughts, and somewhat unconscious and correlated discursive emotions, discursive thinking, afflictive emotions that are sort of driving your thought. But the ideal, I think, is there, and it's you can see it reflected clearly in Dogen and in Hanji. And it might be titled Silent Illumination, or it might even be called Enlightenment. It's also just sitting, practicing, in Dogen's words. So we strive for non-thinking, and the koan on what non-thinking is one monk, when asked what he was doing while sitting, or what he was thinking about while he was sitting, said non-thinking. And when asked how one does non-thinking, he said thinking, non-thinking. The little problem in that is that your thinking, non-thinking is doing something, and in Zazen you're relaxing or resting, just resting in this presence, not thinking, not involved, not going forward on a train of thought or on a undercurrent of planning or wanting to do something else. Another key word is upright. In Zazen, that's very important, and no one has exactly explained why, but what we try to do is to almost stretch our spine to achieve some sort of uprightness. Some of us are better than others. I won't cite any examples, but I see several. But even bringing your jaw back in Zazen to sort of tighten your face muscles and enact the muscles on your back of your head to help lift your spine. Putting your tongue on the top of your mouth. If you have saliva in your mouth, you're accumulating it. You should be aware of that and swallowing it. And maintaining that uprightness. Dogen also said someplace that Zazen, what we think of as sitting meditation or just sitting, has nothing to do with sitting or standing or lying down. And I suspect it's that uprightness, non-thinking and non-hindering, that he is alluding to, which is, you can get a better understanding of what it is by reading Hanji and Dogen, but it's still close to sort of a brilliance, illumination. There are a lot of ways to deal with non-hindering. And one formula that I like, one is just don't hinder. Just do it. Stop it. That's a little bit abrupt, and that sort of disrupts your mentality. So the acronym RAIN is one. Thinking of the gentle rain that's happening now. But the successive letters of that four-letter word stand for recognition, just recognizing what you're doing while you're sitting. Are you thinking? Are emotions churning? Do you want something? Are you wondering why, or are you wondering if you've got it, or are you trying harder, which is a mistake? All those things are concurrent, and the recognition is just to understand that that's happening. The A is for acceptance. Just to accept that that is part of you and ongoing. The I is for investigation. Are there deeper roots? Are there emotions that are driving that train of thought? Something that you're into. Something that you've been doing before and come back to and do repeatedly, frequently. The N is for non-identification. You accept, investigate, but you don't identify, that's me, I'm caught in that. You recognize that there's a big universe and that you yourself are have lots of aspects and lots of variety in your current orientation. You have a lot of support because you're sitting upright or you're standing or lying upright, you're maintaining your posture. To come back to another couple of key words, love and compassion. It's very hard for me to even talk about them because I am, it's not my forte, and I recognize that women in general are much better equipped to deal with these topics. And physiologically, there are a number of studies of the neurology of the brain that show that women have much greater areas of the brain that are sensitive to facial expressions, emotional context, etc., much better able to deal and much more aware of what's going on in these terms. But nevertheless, the Tibetan Zen doesn't deal so much with training in love or compassion explicitly. One aspiration of my poem is that it really happens anyway, and it happens through maybe decades of sitting, maybe years of sitting, maybe a moment of sitting, maybe successive lifetimes, but it still grows and flourishes somehow. And you become aware of that, and it's not necessarily you, it's just part of our nature or part of the underlying field that's far beyond form and emptiness, maybe. But Tibetan Buddhism, which is very close to the Zen, the objectless, the meditation, also has something called Lojong teachings. And one statement of that I like is, the essence of all teachings taught by the Lord Buddha concern taming one's mind. The point being to return the mind to its natural state of freedom, which is endowed with limitless qualities. That's what I read as true or original nature. The realization of this natural state gives rise to spontaneous compassion that is limitless and impartial, gives us the freedom to embrace the world by enhancing our capacity for compassion, love, and perseverance. Coming back to upright, why we're trying to have an upright spine in this sitting, that I think Hakubai in the Martin Moscow mentioned that the upright posture is a way to balance your chakras. So if you're understanding and sympathetic to that view, it's a way of keeping aligned. In the book, Being Upright by Reb Anderson, teacher at Zen Center San Francisco, Green Gulch specifically, his book is on the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, and it's titled Being Upright. So each of the precepts, the sort of the guidelines for our practice, are aspects of being upright. He also wrote a book, let's see what it was called, The Third Turning, in which he said something like, and I somehow lost it, that a Buddha is one who sees things as they really are. And through this practice, we realize how things really are. We become aware that our self nature, is visited with self-fixation, and that our true nature is without self. That in becoming aware of this without self nature, or without nature, the self that we make up in our minds, a great love arises somewhat spontaneously and compassionately from this realization. And that love causes Buddhas to want to awaken beings, to make them aware that we're all in this together, we're all connected, we're all part of each other. Everything is connected to everything else. One of the obvious. And everyone is even more connected to everyone else. I have a few readings from Koban, the teacher who founded this temple. One of them is on compassion, and the second is on enlightenment. So we'll get to that. Judy, you may be able to identify where I got these. I don't remember. Koban was asked in one of his discussions, how does compassion come out of emptiness? And his answer, a little bit long, was, compassion sounds very fancy, just the sound of the word. Out of compassion, you do this. If you say that, no one can say it's no good. Very fancy stuff. I don't know. It's something fancy. It relates with deep, painful knowledge of selflessness when you're out of a job, so to speak. You don't benefit. If there is a speck of beneficial mind attached to energy, it cannot be compassionate. It becomes some kind of negotiation, an intense promise, or something. Compassionate mind is very foolish mind in one way. It just drains your energy year after year, and you feel you are stupid doing that. And yet you cannot help it. You have to do it. It's an inner demand. Even if it's not beneficial at all, you do it. Sitting is the best example. I found the real quote from Reb's book, so I'll read it. I think it's worth reading. A Buddha who sees is someone who sees the way things really are. When we see the way things really are, we see that we're all in this together, that we're all interdependent. A great surpassing love arises from that wisdom, and that love leads a Buddha to wish that all beings would open to this wisdom and be free of the misery that arises from ignoring the way things are. Buddhas appear in the world because they want us to have a Buddha's wisdom, so that we will love every single being completely and protect every single being without exception, without limit, just as all Buddhas do. Another brief poem, somewhat parallel to Mary Oliver's poem. When you look for God, God is in the look of your eyes, in the thought of your looking, nearer to you than you yourself, or things that have happened to you. There's no need to go outside. Like melting snow, wash yourself of yourself. So the final reading from Koban is talking about this process of awakening. Dark inside, mind's state is dark. It's blindness, physically only, sun, moon shine on your body, skin appears black or white or yellowish. Inside is dark, bloody. Seems nothing is in it but something flesh, bloody. Don't know which direction this energy is directed. Each individual human being, except fully enlightened ones amongst you, most of us are utterly blind. We don't know other people almost at all. Then a rush of knowledge comes to you, and everything seems crystal clear. Now you say, I am knowledged, and you start to teach people about it. A few years later, you discover that it wasn't quite final knowledge. We don't know where we come from in the first place. We don't know when and where we're going. It's almost absurd to get into that state because you're not ready. But awakening takes place. Most of us freak out, end up going to a mental hospital or given doses of tranquilizers or something. There's no person to really speak about your experience. You're even embarrassed to speak about it. Many of you keep a secret diary in which your secret experience is all written down. No one can see it. Only the very closest person can see that what it says is a scream that my mind cannot sit. What shall I do? It's none of my business. One might talk about, discuss what it means to be enlightened. It is something to do with going back to what you actually are. It's not like what you become. That's an idea. It's not someday or somewhere from this place, from what you are. And sitting in meditation, being who you are, is something to do with this facing to your own true self, not made up or taught or wished to be. He says, finally, any questions? A very pointless talk. So,
I'd like to have, I hope you'll read again your rendering. That was the hail made it, we couldn't hear it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, I can't hear many of you also, so it's sort of reciprocal. But it's actually posted.
Well, it's posted. Okay.
But, yeah. It's in the heart of the ancient practice to free and awaken all beings. Compassion grows through upright non-thinking. Love blossoms through upright non-hindering. As your compassion grows through upright non-thinking, your mind flirts with immediacy. As your love flowers through upright non-hindering, your mind's dualities and fixations on self fade. As mind approaches immediacy, defilements and hindrances drop away. In upright non-thinking and non-hindering, experience is neither general nor particular. If your true nature resumes itself, immediacy evolves with no obstacles. If your intimate experience is neither general nor particular, upright effort is without desire, etc. It's posted on Jikoji Archives, and on that page, or archive.jikoji.org, and on that page is something called Sites Honoring Koban, which is off to the left set of links, and underneath that there are students' poems. And it begins with a poem that Michael circulated some time ago from the Lotus Sutra on Jikoji and its function in the world. So it's worth going to that page at least. And the heart of Zazen is maybe the third link on that page. Too much.
We're learning about trust. Like, in Zazen, I feel like a lot of my experiences have been about control. Trying to control it very hard, but it's very painful. And then I'm thinking, like, maybe trust is less painful, but it's more scary. Are we meant to trust?
I would, I'm old, so I would take care of the pain in some way. Like, you might move your seat or adjust your posture. And if the pain is psychological or emotional, then maybe, and it's unbearable, than talking to someone who's a professional. But if not, you can't not do this, is my experience. And something requires me to sit. Michelle?
Thank you for your talk, Cliff. So when I first started sitting Zazen, can you hear me, Cliff?
Yeah, thank you.
Like I'm in the theater. When I first started sitting Zazen, I was crying a lot. And then I stumbled upon this lovely practitioner who told me that crying was not Zazen, and I got a little bit confused. So now I'm trying to solve the great mystery of Zazen. What if the hell is this thing? And I'm wondering if you have a perspective on if crying is Zazen.
I envy you, you're crying.
Thank you.
Since adolescence, almost no tears. I don't know why. I think I got caught up in a social currents, competitiveness and so on. I think it's a very healthy thing to do. The awareness and taking care of it as best you can. Todd?
Thank you, Cliff. I have to ask again what if you wouldn't mind expanding on what you said about words lie.
Oh, that's
too big a topic.
No, it's an easy topic. The sentence says it for itself. Words lie, can't be true. If it's true, it's a false. It says it's false. If it's false, then it says it's true. It's a paradox. And that this sentence is false is more particular, says that. And there was a great, I guess, at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a great stimulus in mathematics and science to put everything in metamathematical terms to derive everything from some very simple axioms. And the result of that was paradox and incompleteness, inconsistency. Okay. People gave up. Still very important, I think, to recognize the truth underlying that as what's foundation of our particular society, these truths are self-evident and so on, the beginning of the Declaration of Independence, the equality. Even now, you know, we're worried about what justice is about in the courts and how do you judge, and the fundamental comes down again and again to equality. The spirit, this Buddha nature, maybe this intrinsic human nature, pretty much equal across amongst us. Thank you, Todd. Ying, who will be giving the talk next week?
Yeah, on a very different topic, but because I'm pregnant, I'm thinking about life's journey quite a bit. So I want to say something here about age. And in this culture, people don't talk about age or old age a lot. So I hope that you don't take it as... I speak with great reverence for age, basically. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, essentially being an octogenarian, do you find it with many decades of practice, is it easier to act without hindrance? Is it easier to wash yourself off yourself in the moment to moment? Is it easier, you know, basically, and what is the your goal in terms of practice for the rest of your life?
The latter is easy. Just we get through this moment, we move on to the next moment. Get through this day, we move on to the next day. The appropriate response. I don't think it's necessarily easier. There's a lot of people who say old age is a really tough thing to do. And a lot of people who say that dying is just losing interest in the face of increasing resistance to continuing. So there's that playing out. It's just different. It changes continuously. I talk about myself and about where I came from, and I love to tell stories about that, but I recognize that they're lies. I haven't got the vaguest idea of how this all happened, really. So it's just ongoing change, I think. And the aspiration and inspiration is just to maintain practice and to live day to day, moment to moment, with awakening, with awareness.
Tibetan, if I could add a little bit, Tibetan Buddhism almost sees the entirety of practice as preparation for the moment of death. You're aware of that?
Okay.
And, you know, I do think for a lot of people who practice, that is a big goal. And, you know, and there are many stories of essentially enlightened death, because death is really not the end, right? Life is a continuation. Life continues. That, you know, the opposite of death is not life, it's birth. And I know you don't believe in reincarnation and so on. However, do you have a sense of the continuation of something after? I'm challenging you a little bit as a scientist and technologist, but if I could challenge you, I'm curious.
Yeah. I think there's awareness, although, you know, I don't embody this fully. But there's awareness that the continuation is in terms of our influences. So I live in part because of my influences, and some of them are good, some of them are bad. My Catholic upbringing tells me if I make a perfect confession in the last moment, I'm in. But I'm happy with just restraining. Practice, to me, again, this is the heart of Zazen, is the idea is it's not in the end, it's in the promulgation sideways, more or less. Not in the ancient teachers themselves, but in what they have, what's going out from it.
Snowing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Thank you for the talk. And this is a thought that is forming in my head, so it's there's no clarity to my question, but it's more like a comment. I'm a little intrigued by the word, by the idea of words being lies. And I think when you say words might be imperfect, they might not be absolute truth, but lots of times they're all we have got, and we should not condemn them to be lies because they don't measure up to an ideal of perfect communication. In lots of ways, beyond everything else, as human beings, as part of the civilization, words are imperfect instruments to connect to other people, to tell our stories. And there are lots of people who, without words, will be even more impoverished than what they are in their current state. So all they have got is words. Mm-hmm. And by imposing this wonderful ideal of there is no perfect communication, so all words are lies, we are depriving people of a chance to connect, I think, in some ways, to express their stories, to tell what they want, to be fully human beings, because words make us human in lots of ways. That's That's our ability to connect, to read the Heart Sutra. You might experience it and embody it over a period of time, but it's a set of words, and it is one way the Dharma has been transmitted. So don't condemn words, because sometimes they are all we've got.
That is true too.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.